Coastal Cafe. I'm Aaron Barnett, your host today. Coastal Cafe is a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington's College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. Today we have a very special show. We have Tara Galuska, the Orca Recovery Coordinator from the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office, and Julie Watson, who is the Killer Whale Policy Lead of Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. Welcome, Tara and Julie.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, to start off with, we are sitting between Mission Creek Estuary and Ellis Cove at Priest Point Park on Bud Inlet, just outside of Olympia on a beautiful early fall day. And I'm going to start with you, Tara. Can you give me some background on what the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office does, its mission, where it started, and the office that it works out of?
Sure. Well, the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office was created by law, by statute, with the Salmon Recovery Act 77.85. And what happened is that when salmon started to become listed in Washington State, the state took some attention because we had just gone through the spotted owl listing and the federal government doing a recovery plan for spotted owls and all of the impacts that that had on local communities. And so as a state, I think the state kind of banded together and said, well, let's try something different and let's pass the Salmon Recovery Act and create a salmon recovery structure where the salmon recovery plans are written, implemented, and bought off on at the local level and submitted to NOAA for approval. And so that's what Washington State has done. And the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office was created to help oversee, to basically help establish regions to oversee the writing of the recovery plans, and now we are in the implementation phase. And so that the mission of the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office is to help oversee salmon recovery planning and salmon recovery implementation in the state.
So when you mention local level within that statute, what do you mean? What does that look like?
Sure. So there are 8 different salmon recovery regions in Washington State that have pulled together, and each region has an executive director, and that region takes responsibility for writing a recovery plan. So, for example, here in Puget Sound, it's the Puget Sound Partnership. It serves as the recovery region for Puget Sound Chinook. And so each region has a recovery plan that they're responsible for writing, updating, and maintaining. And now the plans have been approved by NOAA, and we are in the implementation process. And what that means is now we're doing salmon habitat restoration, acquisition projects identified in those recovery plans. And so those are the regions, and they are funded through the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund. So NOAA actually helps fund those regions. The Washington State includes them in their application to NOAA for that salmon funding, federal salmon funding. And the other thing that's identified in the statute are salmon recovery lead entities. So if you're not familiar with the term lead entity, what that is sort of there's salmon jumping right in front of us, probably Chinook coming back. The lead entities are watershed groups, and so that's really the grassroots of salmon recovery in Washington State. The state is geographically where there's a recovery region, there's always a lead entity, and sometimes it's a one-to-one relationship, and sometimes there's multiple lead entities within a region. So Puget Sound is a great example of that. There are 15 lead entities in Puget Sound. Washington Coast has four lead entities, covering the coast, and then I think all of the other recovery regions, like along the Columbia, it's one lead entity, one region. And the lead entity specifically is responsible for bringing together a technical group and a citizens group, and they are responsible for bringing forward projects to implement out of the recovery plan to the Salmon Recovery Funding Board for funding. And so they're local collectives of watershed groups and people that are passionate and engaged in salmon recovery. It's been really fun to work with them. I'm in my previous position, before I was the Orca Recovery Coordinator, I managed the salmon programs at the Recreation and Conservation Office. So I had a lot of engagement with those lead entities. They are really the front-facing folks on the ground doing the hard work of salmon recovery around Washington State. And they do that on an annual basis, bring those lists forward, but they do also a lot of communication around salmon recovery, outreach, you know, getting people involved and caring about salmon recovery in their communities. And so they're a really important, you know, local facing entities that help us try to move the needle on our recovery plans.
So as the Orca Recovery Coordinator, which is your position, you've been in for what, a year or two?
No, only since July.
Okay.
Started in, at the end of June, kind of transitioned out, from my salmon job right into Orca recovery. So a few months.
So what do your new duties entail, and what are you tasked with doing as the recovery coordinator?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this is a brand new position in Washington State, and it's really, really exciting that it's been supported by the Washington State Legislature and the governor. And what happened is, you know, our orcas, southern resident killer whales, that which is a, you know, a distinct population of killer whales that eat salmon. We have those in Puget Sound, and we also have Biggs killer whales, which are known as transients or Biggs, and they are marine mammal or seal or porpoise-eating killer whales. The ones that are listed as an endangered species through the Endangered Species Act, they are the ones that eat salmon. And so what happened is they became... I could give you a little bit of history on orcas if you'd like.
Please.
Okay. Back in the 70s, the population status was unknown. We didn't know how many of those killer whales, unique killer whales, we had in Salish Sea. But the, there's so many salmon jumping. But the animal, the aquariums of the world started coming in and doing some wild animal captures. And so that declined the population a bit, and then was like, oh, we need to know how many there are. And so back in the late 90s, the population, they declined to around in the 70s. And then in the late 90s, they got back up to the 90s. Now we're down to 73 individuals left. Of course, that the marine trade it doesn't happen any longer, and we are in total recovery mode for this really endangered population. And they were listed with NOAA, NOAA. Hopefully, everybody on the radio here knows NOAA. They were listed as endangered, and they were continuing to decline. And so it was really concerning to Governor Jay Inslee. It was concerning to citizens of the state. It was really concerning to people who cared about and lived in this ecosystem. I mean, they're just such an amazing creature. They're the top of the food chain, major predator. And so Governor Locke put together an executive order to create a task force to do something about these killer whales and take action, basically. And so that task force met over a two-year period and created 49 recommendations to really try to move the needle on orca recovery and try to get the population numbers up. And so part of those task force recommendations were this, were a position or a structure to carry on the mission of the task force. And so that position was created and funded by the legislature. There was a little bit of a delay because of COVID. So hence, that's the reason I just started 3 months ago. And so my goal is to, a fewfold, really is to have accountability for the recommendations, make sure that our state partners are doing their part, which they are. It's been amazing, all of the activities that have been happening since the task force sunsetted. And so that's a big role of mine, is just keeping tabs on the task force recommendations, working with stakeholders and the public, communicating about southern resident killer whales, working with folks like Julie and NOAA. And one of the things I want to do is build a website and provide information to the public about southern resident killer whales and about the work of the task force and each recommendation, so people can go in and see what we're doing and what kind of actions have taken place. There's so much, and we really need to share that with folks.
Well, this is great. You've actually answered about three of my questions. So now I can move on to the important question, and is that if you could comment on the current health and state of the southern resident pod, and then if you could also comment on some of the tools that you're providing folks, you know, what would you expect to have on your website, what information people are going to get, how they can find it, and things like that.
That's great. So the current health, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, they're very endangered. They're imagine with only 73 individuals left, they are one of the more, near extinct marine mammals in the world. I think the vaquita porpoise in Mexico has only 20 individuals left. So, you know, we're talking a very small population, and what's important is for them to be able to breed and successfully breed, and that's been one of the problems, is having successful calves, successful births, and successful a birth rate, and then for those calves to mature. And we need breeding individuals in the population. Right now, there's you might hear southern resident killer whales referred to as pods. So we have three pods. We have J pod, K pod, and L pod. To give you a sense of the health of the whales, J pod has 24 individuals. K pod has 16. And L pod has 33, and we get this information from the Center for Whale Research, which maintains Orca Survey, and they've been doing photo survey documentation since the 70s, I believe. And so K pod hasn't had a successful birth since 2011. We just lost this year in August of 2021, K21, a 35-year-old adult male. And then just the timing is interesting of this interview. We just heard yesterday that a member of L-Pod, L-47, an adult female matriarch, as these whales live in matriline, so the offspring stay with the mother or the grandmother their whole lives. And so she was the matriarch of a subgroup of the L-Pod. And she has not been seen for a number of months. And so the Center for Whale Research just put out a post yesterday that they are assuming that she's deceased. So we went into the summer with 75 individuals, and we're now at 73. But we have to have hope, and we have to keep taking action for these beautiful animals. And on the flip side, on a positive note, there are three identified pregnancies, late stage pregnancies in the J pod, and Julie's going to talk a little bit in a bit about some of the work that Department of Fish and Wildlife has been doing, because the threats to these whales really revolve primarily around, I mean, the three, if I had to just say the top three threats to the whales, salmon prey, their main diet, and you know, we have 14 listed species in Washington State of salmon, five of which are Chinook, and their main diet, I think, and Julie will correct me if I'm wrong, but over 80% of their diet is Chinook, could be even higher at certain times of the year. And so, you know, with their diet being also endangered, that's a big issue. And then vessels, also the noise of vessels. We need quieter waters, so that these are marine mammals that echolocate, which means they bounce sound around off of objects to find their food and to communicate with one another. So we need quieter waters so that their foraging and their communication with each other is not impacted. And then contaminants have been an issue. They have contaminants in their blubber. The transient or Biggs killer whales are one of the most toxic marine mammals in the world, in their blubber. And so southern resident killer whales, if they don't have enough to eat, they get skinnier. And then that any toxins in their whale fat starts getting into their body more when they're getting skinnier. And so we want to clean up toxic hotspots in Puget Sound. We want to be really conscientious about stormwater entering into the waters, and also wastewater. You know, the way you dispose of your medications, hazardous materials, all of that. We all need to be responsible for some of those things on a daily basis. And I can talk a little more about actions, but do you want to get into some of the regulations on?
Yeah, we'll talk to Julie here in a minute. Okay. And if you're just joining us, this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and I'm Aaron Barnett, today's host of Coast Cafe, and we're speaking with Tara Galeska, the Orca Recovery Coordinator for the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office, and Julie Watson, the Killer Whale Policy Lead at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we are on the beautiful shores of beautiful Bud Inlet in beautiful Washington State on the beautiful Salish Sea. So, Julie, Tara went into some of the, you know, whys and issues bringing the need for increased policy or increased regulations and heightened attention to the southern resident killer whale. Could you talk about the new distance regulations, other threats that can impact the pod? But let's start with the regulations. And how did they come about, and when exactly, what are they? What are the new regulations?
Sure. Yeah. So in 2019, there were a few big bills in our state legislature that were based on those task force recommendations that Tara was talking about. And one of those was to increase the approach distance of how close boats can get to southern resident killer whales. So in 2019, the legislature passed a bill that was signed by Governor Inslee that increased the distance from 200 yards to 300 yards on the side. And it was already 400 yards to the front. So you're really not supposed to cut off the whales that would try to like hopscotch and get in their way. So that was in place, but they also added 400 yards to the back. So it kind of creates this oblong shaped bubble around the whales to give them space. And as Tara was talking about, there's a couple reasons for that. It's not just that we don't want these whales to get hit by boats. They're pretty smart, although collisions have happened in the past. The big issue is that they need to use echolocation and clicks to find their priority food, which is the Chinook salmon. So if they can't hear, which we have some really cool models out there of the way it sounds underwater to the whales, if they can't hear, they can't find their food, and then they get thinner and thinner, and that's when those other threats kick in. So prey availability really has to be coupled with a decrease in noise so that these whales can find their food. So those distance regulations went into effect. It turns out that boats are much louder when they're going fast. So there's also a new speed regulation that you have to slow down to 7 knots when you're within a half mile bubble of those whales. And then there were some other pieces of that as well. We focus on, at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, sharing about those regulations and other best practices for operating vessels around whales, which include encouraging people to view from shore through these things called the Be Whale Wise guidelines. And that's a big partnership between a lot of the state agencies, federal agencies, and even our Canadian counterparts. But on the other side, the Department of Fish and Wildlife was also instructed to license commercial whale watching boats and put some new regulations into effect for how often, how close, how many boats could commercially view southern residents at a time. So we've done that, and that included a new thing that we're actually testing out for the first time this year, where we can declare an individual whale vulnerable. And that creates a little bit of extra protection, at least from commercial whale watching vessels, for those individuals. And we're hoping that the public will join in as well and also give some extra space, staying a half mile away or just viewing from shore for those individuals. And just recently, we heard that there are 3 pregnant killer whales in J-Pod, and we were really excited about that. And it turns out that pregnant whales in late stage pregnancy need extra food so that they're preparing to give birth and feed their babies. And we really want the mom and the baby to survive the birthing process. They lose a lot of their babies. So we actually issued an emergency rule that makes those 3 whales a little bit extra protected. And so we're really excited about these new tools that we have that help us give a little more space to the whales. NOAA showed some research earlier this year. They published a study that showed when vessels are within 400 yards, especially for female orcas, they'll give up on trying to find food. They just go back into traveling mode instead of finding food, and we really need them to find the food. So the vessel regulations piece of this whole puzzle is really important in conjunction with all those other actions.
How have you found the recreational boating industry and community respond to your regulations?
We have a lot of great partners in the recreational boating associations, the Be Whalewise partnership will often have booth at the boat shows and talk to people. And there's a lot of encouragement there. We work with San Juan County, and they put out a thing called the Whale Warning Flag. And that idea there is that people waving the flag will let other boaters know, hey, there are whales nearby, any kind of whales. So slow down, be careful, keep an eye out. And so the recreational boating community there has been really great. They're always helping us spread the word. Unfortunately, not all of the private boaters get the message, which is why there's also some great folks out on the water. There's an organization called Soundwatch, and they're out there doing education around whales. And then WDFW has enforcement officers, and they're often out there too, intercepting boats that don't realize that they're about to run into the middle of a group of whales, and educating people and helping bring them up to speed about the regulations. So I think that there's a lot of goodwill and intent. People want to do the right thing around these whales. There's also a strong drive for people to get that selfie or to get that really good picture of a whale breaching, and that's not always what's best for the whales. So we're really trying to spread the word and get people to join us in giving them extra space so that they can survive and we can all enjoy them for future generations.
Well, I would assume that somebody from the Midwest who comes out here to and charters a boat, you know, to go see that, they're not going to know unless that information is passed on to them when they rent their boat, which doesn't always happen, I would assume. Now, you listed threats such as sound, lack of food, noise. How about fish finders and depth sounders? Are they something that boaters and operators should be cognizant of?
Yeah, that's a great point. And there is some guidance out there about how to use fish finders and whatnot safely around whales. It turns out there's one of the frequencies that a lot of them have dual frequency. One of those frequencies can really get in the way for southern residents. So if that's the frequency you use, it's best to just turn them off as long as it's safe to do so. But if you have the other frequency, even just switching it to that other frequency is a good tip that makes it a little easier for the whales to hear. So turning them off if you can is always a good idea if whales are around.
So, you know, boating season is officially over here. Do you have any idea of how not only the commercial whale watching industry responded, but other vessels as well? Do you have any indication on how people responded over the summer?
Well, sadly, we don't see the southern residents here all the time in the summer. The last several years, they used to do a thing that was called the West Side Shuffle, where J-Pod especially would be going back and forth on the west side of San Juan Island, which is a protected area. It's a voluntary no-go zone for recreational boats, and it's an official no-go zone for commercial whale-watching boats. So they'd be there all the time, but recently they haven't come back as much. Thankfully, they did come back in September and have been around a lot this month so far, so that's really exciting. But I think that the commercial whale watching industry is adjusting. It's giving us a chance to test out. These regulations just went into effect at the beginning of this year. So they're getting used to the new system. They're reporting to a thing called the Whale Report app, which helps inform the large tanker ships or the ferries. Hey, there's whales up ahead. Slow down, be aware. They're doing a lot of great stuff to help be partners in conservation, and I'm hoping we can continue to grow that partnership over time. And I think the more we get the word out about the rules and about the best practices and guidelines and how people can support whales, the more recreational boaters will join us in helping this conservation effort as well.
So, you know, the Canadian border is pretty much right in the area these whales live. What can you say about what has happened in Canada? What kind of regulations has the government of British Columbia put in place that are comparable to what we've done here in the U.S.?
That's a great question. So our Canadian counterparts, Transport Canada and DOF, Department of Oceans and Fisheries Canada, have their own version of a task force that's been meeting, and they've done interim regulations every year for the past several years where they're trying out different things and learning from them. Eventually, we expect that they will also adopt permanent regulations, and a big value for Tara and I is to work together with those counterparts and make sure that it makes sense and that folks aren't getting confused as they cross the border with what rules are in place where. So the Canadians made Unfortunately, we were also dealing with a different system of measurement. So the Canadians have a 400 meter approach distance on all sides of southern resident killer whales, and they've signed an agreement with some of the commercial whale watching companies to not view southern residents in exchange for being able to view transient killer whales a little closer. Transient killer whales are those ones that eat marine mammals, and they're doing pretty well at the moment. So there's a couple differences there. Canada's also established a couple interim sanctuary zones where they're trying to keep all vessels out to see if that might be a good acoustic refuge where the whales might go and look for food. And they're working on an effort as well to study the way vessel traffic comes in and out of the Salish Sea and whether there's anything we can do with those traffic lanes to create more spaces for southern residents to do their thing and find some food.
Well, this has been very informative. So we're going to wrap it up here. Tara, is there anything you'd like to add before we close?
Well, I just think we'd be remiss to not mention climate change, since we are in the process of heating up our planet a bit, and we've all noticed those repercussions more and more over the last couple summers, and that definitely has an impact on the food web overall. So just something to keep in mind that we all need to have that on our radar and take action at a global, national, and state scale, which Governor Inslee just passed the Climate Commitment Act, and so, you know, we're looking ahead to the future. And also our partners at NOAA are doing some great things as well by expanding the critical habitat of the southern resident killer whales to the Washington coast and taking the killer whales into consideration with fishing management decisions. And that could be maybe a whole other radio show.
We'll do it. Thank you, Tara. And now, Julie, is there anything you'd like to add before we close?
Yeah, just one more thing. Prey availability is super important, as we know, and part of that is hatcheries, part of that is thinking about fisheries, part of that is restoring and protecting the habitat in our region. And this Orca Recovery Day coming up in October, October 16th, will be a great opportunity for folks who are interested to go volunteer with one of your local conservation districts or another organization to do an on-the-ground habitat restoration project. It feels good, it makes things better for the salmon, and we all need to save the salmon because that's a critical part of saving the whales.
And that's www.bettergrounds.com to sign up for an action for Orca Recovery Day coming right up next month.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you both so much. And thanks for bringing me down here to this great little spot on beautiful Butt Inlet. And thank you all for joining us. This is Aaron Barnett. You've been listening to Coastal Cafe, a joint production of Washington Sea Grant at the University of Washington College of the Environment and KPTZ 91.9 FM. Washington Sea Grant helps people and marine life thrive by providing research, technical expertise, and education that supports the conservation of our ocean and coastlines. I'd like to thank our program director, Larry Stein, and production engineer, Jared Dufresne. And as always, a special shout out to the band Ku Ich for sharing their music with us at the open and closing of this program. Thank you for listening and have a good day. Hatuasiku, ha,